Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca. And my guest today is Jack Rasmus. I'm delighted to have Jack back. Before I give him a formal introduction for those who haven't heard him before, which you've missed, but at least you'll catch up today with the most current information material that Jack wants to pass on. I've had a couple of interviews myself this week, and also today there was an AP report I'll mention very briefly on the so-called swine flu scare. Well, AP today reports the hype to scare people to death will slowly begin picking up, and I expect it to get into high gear next month. Well, AP has a report out this morning, an interview with a WHO, World Health Organization official, and he says that 100,000 infections in England already, WHO estimates possibly as many as 2 billion people may be infected over the next 2 years. Well, I call WHO what it is. It's a criminal organization. It's run by the giant drug companies and the other giant healthcare providers. For their interest, for their profit, we'll have programs. We've already had one on the swine flu business. We'll have more ahead as the scare machine gets into high gear. But so far, there's no basis for it whatsoever. I put together a one-minute PSA that Republic will air on different programs. I did it live on this program once before. Let me do it again. Runs 1 minute, and it goes like this. This is an emergency public service announcement. On June 11th, the World Health Organization declared its highest level 6 swine flu pandemic alert, even though then and now no forensically proved swine flu death occurred anywhere in the world. Then on July 13th, the WHO recommended vaccinations for everyone, stopping just short of declaring a global emergency and mandating them. That's coming next as we approach the fall flu season. Swine flu vaccines are experimental, untested, toxic, and extremely dangerous to the human immune system. They contain substances that cause a host of annoying to life-threatening autoimmune diseases and must be avoided, even if mandated. That's the PSA. I don't say this lightly. I have quoted scientific experts who basically say the same thing, people who don't show up on CNN and the other places. Anyway, we'll get into this another time. Today we'll talk about the economy with Jack Rasmus. Jack is a professor of political economy at St. Mary's College and Santa Clara University. He's also a freelancer journalist, a frequent speaker, a playwright, and the author of The War at Home, The Bush Corporate Offensive Against American Workers and Their Unions. His new books include, oh, I hope I have it right this time. I botched it at least one previous time. The Trillion Dollar Income Shift, Essays on Income Inequality in America, and Epic Recession and Global Financial Crisis. So we want to talk about this epic recession. Jack, I welcome you again. It's terrific having you back.
My pleasure.
I hope you don't mind my diversion for a moment. And I wanted to time it so I took up no more than the first few minutes. So I hear that music. Let's take that break, come back, and then you pick it up and explain exactly where things stand now in the global economy. We'll be right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Jack Rasmus, talking about the economy. Jack, the last article of yours I read in the summer issue of Z Magazine, it's a great title. You call it Green Shoots or Stinkweeds, and you list, we talked about it last time, you list 18 reasons why we're in big trouble. Is that available online yet? It's been out in print for, I guess a few weeks. Can listeners access it online?
Yes, it will be available on my website starting tomorrow.
We'll give you a website. So
yeah, the website is Kyklos Productions, and that's spelled K-Y-K-L-O-S, Productions, plural, all one word, .com, KyklosProductions.com. And also interested listeners can access my various video and audio presentations, including the workshop that I gave to the labor councils in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area here, that recently had a workshop on the economic crisis. I'm an advisor to the labor councils in the Bay Area, San Francisco Labor Council.
Well, I heard part of it on a KDFA program. I think it was Against the Grain.
Oh, yeah, KPFA.org.
KPFA,
yes.
I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
They had a fundraiser going, so they couldn't play at all, but I think I heard about 20 minutes or maybe 30 minutes. It was a great talk. It was a terrific talk.
Yeah, well, I tried to put it all in historical perspective. this event here that we've gotten the last couple of years has immediate roots going back at least to the late 1980s and much longer historical roots going back to the 1970s. In effect, what we've got here is a breakdown of the solutions that they put together in the late 70s, early 80s, they meaning most of the key global capitalist powers, particularly UK, US, and others, to try to solve the crisis of the 1970s when the world economy pretty much slowed to a halt. That sometimes is called the neoliberalism or Thatcherism or Reaganism or whatever. But it's a set of specific policies that were put together to get the capitalist accumulation engine going again, which it did, but at some very great costs, including a progressive shrinking of income on the part of working and middle classes, at the same time increasing instability potential in the financial system. Those are two legacies of this whole solution that they put together, which have come to a crisis point here in the mid-aughties, if you want to call the first decade of this century. And now they have to find a totally new set of policies and solutions if they want to get the whole thing going again. But right now they're just trying to put out the fires, and they haven't really put together a new solution. Part of it, you can see parts of it beginning to emerge. Their proposals for having the Federal Reserve, of all places, become the key regulator of the financial side of the system, which is really interesting, since the banks pretty much control the Federal Reserve in any event. But there's big splits in the capitalist class over that question, and big debates over who's going to regulate, how much they're going to regulate, as part of putting together this whole new proposal, whole new strategy. But it's going to be interesting to see whether they can. The system on the consumption side the last several decades has run based on taking away income from the working classes and giving them credit and debt to keep consumption going. Well, that trade-off doesn't appear to be able to work, and if they're continuing to extract at the expense of the working classes their income, where are they going to get the consumption from is a big question, because they're not going to be able to do it with debt anymore.
They're doing nothing to create jobs. They're really destroying jobs. Just a couple of quick comments. Giving the Fed more power is like appointing a firebug fire commissioner. To me, the Fed is maybe culprit number one that's created this crisis in the first place. And you live in California. I mean, you're right in the middle of an economic holocaust going on right now. And the solution is to hurt people, fire them, destroy jobs, cut social services. How on earth do you get the economy going doing stuff like that?
Well, it's not a proposal for getting the economy going. It's really a stopgap, and the shame of it all. I mean, mean, it's really disgusting what's going on in Sacramento, because if you look at the package they put together a couple of days ago, not one penny in tax increases for wealthy or even mid-level incomes. It's all cuts at the expense of kids' education, at the expense of health of the most exposed people, at the expense of just about everything. And I really blame the Democrats for caving in to Schwarzenegger and the Republicans on this, but that's not new. They always cave in when the crunch comes, and that's really the shame of it all, that there is nobody that's willing to stand up, no party, no organization, no representatives, that's really willing to stand up and say no to this whole strategy of making workers and middle-class families pay for this crisis. You know, that's how capitalism kind of works. It creates the mess, makes a huge profit creating a mess, and then turns around and makes a profit on the mess. And that's what we see going here. But there's no solution in this California proposal. It's just another indication that they're hoping to try to stay afloat until the thing recovers on its own. But it's not going to recover on its own.
Jack, is there any possibility that people in the state, or enough people in the state, will get angry enough that they'll stage mass strikes, they'll get out on the street, they'll do something in their own defense, because a lot of people are going to suffer much more than they've suffered up to now. Just job losses alone will be horrendous given the state that we're in right now.
Yes, well, you know, I predicted a year ago that there'd be over 20 million losses. It looks like there's going to be 22 to 25 million job losses here, which is massive, which is another indication of the collapse of consumption that's going on here, which means that you're not going to have a recovery. You'll have periodic slowdowns of the decline, and maybe you'll even have periods of stagnation bumping along the bottom, but you'll have no really clear-cut recovery in terms of consumption. Now, stock market may recover, but even that, you know, fell 50%, and they've only recovered 15%, and they think, wow, this is a big recovery. Well, that's exactly the trajectory that was followed in 29 to 33. There were five stock market recoveries during that period, and all of them were relatively short-lived. They call bear market recoveries, they eventually resulted in a further decline. And we're quite well on that trajectory compared to the Great Depression, and even falling in terms of jobs faster than we did in 1929-31. So that's kind of ominous, and it's all occurring with huge, huge deficits. We've pretty much expended, whatever availability of stimulus might have been on largely bailing out the banks, so there's not much sources of stimulus, unless you're going to destroy the dollar, which may happen, left to use. And so they're just kind of hoping that this thing will recover on its own at this particular point. And I don't see them doing much else. There are some sources calling for a stimulus 2. Actually, it would be stimulus 3, because the first one was in 2008 under Bush in the spring, and we get the first Obama stimulus here. But it's clear it's not enough. But those who have the influence politically in Congress think it is enough, because their collapse has appeared to leveled off, and they don't really care if jobs continue to be lost. Even the Fed chairman, talking on both sides of his mouth, Bernanke this week, saying on the one hand, oh, it looks like there's a recovery and so forth. And then on the other hand, but we're going to lose jobs for a long time to come, and we're going to have to keep interest rates low for a long time to come. Well, that doesn't sound like a recovery. You don't keep interest rates at 0% for a long time if you think you got a recovery, and you certainly don't have a recovery when you continue to lose millions of jobs. So I guess we got a recovery for those who clip coupons. But even in that case, I wouldn't call it recovery. It's just a stagnation. Looks a lot like, beginning to look a lot like Japan in the 90s here, I think, where we're going to have a long L-shaped period here with some ups and downs, but long-term stagnation is what I predict.
Well, Japan went through their lost decade in the 90s to be followed by a lost decade ever since, and I can't imagine they're recovering now given the state of things globally. Yesterday, by the way, I had Paul Craig Roberts on. He said some stunning things about the level of unemployment. If it were calculated based on the formula used in 1980, and I don't know where he got these numbers state by state by state, but he went down a list of states with unemployment rates ranging in the mid-20s, including California. I think Michigan had the highest. He mentioned a number of other states. I mean, shocking unemployment rates if we calculate it on the same basis as 1980. And, of course, they changed the system. They softened it up to hide the real effects of unemployment. So this silly 9.5%, this U3 number they come out with, I mean, it's a preposterous number. Even the Labor Department has a U6 measure, which is 16.5%. I guess the real number based on 1980 calculations is a fair amount above that. So we really have a pretty dismal employment situation right now.
Oh yes, like I said, you know, it's on track, falling even faster than it did during the 1930s in the first couple of years. And you're absolutely right. Since 1980, beginning with Reagan, they've really played loose with how they calculate unemployment and inflation, by the way. And we've got a situation where it's grossly underestimated. We can talk about some of the techniques they've used to grossly underestimate, if you like.
Oh, absolutely. I think that would be a good review. Let's take another break, Jack. Come back, and then you run down this alchemy that they've created to tell us the state of the economy. We'll be right back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Jack Rasmus. Jack, run down what they've done to really corrupt the way they produce this data. And of course, it's not just unemployment; it's all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, well, it would take a long time to give you all the little arcane Bureau of Labor Statistics tricks, but you know, just some of the more major ones here. Let's just take the last couple months. What's called the birth death model, business model. Assumption. They assume that there's a certain amount of small business growth based on small business or originations, creations of small businesses, proprietorships and stuff like that, based on historical long run average. It's hundreds of thousands a month based on an average when times are good. Well, in the last year or so, obviously, we've got far more small business disappearances than we have small business creations. Nonetheless, they continue to assume and plug in this false statistic called the small business birth death model. And just in the last 2 months, for example, that means that they've over-assumed job creation by 200 to 250,000 each month is what they're doing now. That 400,000 of last month is really 650,000, and then they subtract this assumption of the new business creations based on a historical average, not on an actual, what's occurring right now. So that's one major way they pump up the whole numbers. Another way is in 1980, they did not include the military in the labor force. You're talking about millions of people. When you throw them into the labor force, it affects the denominator because unemployment is calculated as a percent of the labor force. So if you increase the labor force size, what you're doing is lowering the unemployment rate. Those are the two favored ways that since 1980 they've overestimated employment and underestimated unemployment. And the other thing is that unemployment is estimated from the current population survey, which is a monthly survey of 60,000 people conducted by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Well, the Bureau of Labor Statistics only approach in their survey people who obviously are going to answer the survey. In other words, if you are an itinerant worker, construction worker, or agriculture worker or something, you're moving around, you're not going to get called, for example. Or if you're an inner city youth, in working the underground economy, trying to stay alive, you're not going to get interviewed. If you're an immigrant worker, you're not going to get interviewed. So that huge population, and we're talking maybe 20, 30 million of people who are most seriously impacted whenever you have a downturn like the present, don't even get interviewed at all. So the whole survey itself, the way it's constructed and who they interview, grossly underestimates unemployment in the economy. That's just three ways. And like you said, GDP and inflation statistics, they've done a lot of things in that regard as well that overestimates GDP and underestimates inflation.
And people believe the numbers they put out. And also, Jack, they always go back and they revise one, two, or more times. But that never gets the headlines, so they can add more to the unemployment figures for last month when they come out with the most recent number. But it doesn't resonate, even if it's a pretty large increase.
Yeah, well, the point is that it's not a real number. It's a statistic. In other words, the statistic is an estimate of an actual real number. But when they tell you how many are unemployed, that's not a real number. That's an estimation based on all these statistical manipulations of the real data that they use, which largely are designed to smooth out and or underestimate the real data.
But the media treats it like it's a real number.
Oh, yeah. They treat it like it's a real number. It's an actual fact. Well, it's not an actual fact, you know.
And then they seasonally adjust.
Yeah, as well. Sometimes, you know, that works in either direction, the seasonal adjustment. That's not such a big issue, I don't think, as some of these other tricks that I mentioned that are employed in the numbers.
The bigger issue would be part-timers. People who work as little as 1 hour in a month being called employed.
Yeah, if they get interviewed, right.
If they're interviewed. And mm-hmm. people who didn't go out and look for a job in the last 30 days because they spent the last year looking and couldn't find anything or whatever. So they're excluded. They're not counted as
right,
employed.
Right. And then there's a whole group of people who are clever enough to know that unemployment insurance is just a joke and they can't survive on it. So they manage to, understandably manipulate their way onto some sort of disability unemployment where they can continue to collect. And that group has been rising significantly as well. And then there's just a group that they call a missing labor force of millions of people that they don't know where to put them. They're certainly not working, but they keep them out of the unemployment calculations that way as well. Yeah.
So it's a real art.
It's a real art that they've got going on how they play with the numbers here. And it doesn't really indicate the level of crisis that still exists, I believe, in the financial system, let alone in the real economy, which is where the crisis has really shifted to more heavily, I believe. But I think if you want to talk about where are the still weaknesses, serious weaknesses in the financial banking side, I'd be glad to do that as well.
Oh, absolutely. Let's begin with that and then talk about weaknesses in the economy. But I also believe that the financial system is in an awful lot of trouble. Let's take the break and we'll come right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour on with Jack Rasmus. Jack, I think one example of the subterfuge about the financial industry's health. I don't know very much about this. I'm not sure if you do either. But apparently a company like Goldman Sachs has some proprietary software that lets them front-run the markets maybe by a split second. Excuse me. So they can initiate trades in the many billions, maybe a trillion trades, that will give them, say, a penny profit per share. But multiply times many billions or a trillion transactions, it ends up an awful lot of money. So last quarter, they made something like $3.5 billion. They're making terrific profits. Their average compensation per employee is $773,000. And they're doing it by subterfuge and manipulation. And I guess the other banks are doing stuff like this, too.
Yes, well, you know, the finance minister of Germany predicted or declared once these stress tests were taken that they were all phony.
surprise.
That they, the public results were the consequence of negotiations between the government and the banks as to what they would allow to report. Now, the big 19 banks that hold 70% of the assets, and there are over 8,000 banks in the United States, I would say at least a dozen of those 19 are still technically insolvent, underwater, and they're preventing that from being publicized. And, of course, you know, J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs, these are the two giants coming out of this whole mess. You know, they aren't necessarily losing money. I don't think they're making as much as they're reporting. You know, it's not all 19 that are in trouble, but the great majority of them are. And then, of course, you've got these 8,200 banks that the FDIC, regional community banks, and there's a estimation that 300 to 900 of those will fail. And they're failing at a rate about 4 or 5 a month, which is, you know, worse than the 1980s. So we've got these regional banks that are really impacted more by the subprimes and the mortgage, and especially the commercial property market, which is really the next bomb that's emerging here of $800 billion potential. That's the next crisis. Then we have close behind that the consumer credit markets. Credit card companies are reducing credit at the rate of $400 billion a quarter. Another example of how consumption is continuing to fall and writing off about $40 billion a quarter. And then right behind that, reports now are beginning to emerge that the pension funds have lost 25 to 33% of their assets. So we have several sectors here, not the big 19. They've sort of stabilized or falsified the situation with the big 19, that's not the whole financial system. There's very much larger parts of the system that are in still very, very deep trouble, and they're continuing to deteriorate. Just last week, the CIT affair, this is the company that lends a lot to small businesses, about a million small businesses dependent on CIT, and CIT is easily technically bankrupt right now, and they're trying to bail it out, but they're not sure how to do that. There are signs of cracks and fault lines still very much throughout the whole financial system. It's still very, very unstable. And what's going to happen is, I believe, what happened in the Depression of the 30s, and that is you have your initial financial crisis, and then it results in a real serious credit crunch throughout the non-financial sectors, leading to all kinds of defaults in non-financial businesses. And Moody's predicts an increase from 5 to 15% in defaults going to occur here, which is a huge number of defaults, by the way. And, you know, that's going to mean more losses for the banking system, particularly the regional community banks. Now, during the Great Depression, the big banks didn't do so bad, and nor did big multinational companies. It was the medium-sized, smaller-sized businesses and banks that really had to paid for the whole depression, and consumers as well, and of course workers and their jobs, and those are the sectors that are going to really be hurt worst. They'll you know, bail out their big friends and keep them afloat, and the rest will pay the price, and that's what's happening now.
And this happened the same way in the 1930s, didn't it, Jack? They saved the big boys and let the small ones go under.
Yes, exactly.
So the same pattern is repeating, I see things that smack of conspiracy to me, I swear, and I tend to look at ones that I really believe are honest to goodness true, and it seems to me that behind this, to some extent, is a scheme to make the big boys bigger and more powerful by eliminating competition, either because they go out of business or let the big boys pick and choose which ones they want to buy up, not just in this country but overseas, again, to get bigger and powerful. And there's no question that the two anointed heads of the pack are Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase.
Yeah, well, that's always been part of a strategy of you know, when they've had financial crises. That is, the worst they let go under, and then they merge the those that still have assets and profitability with the bigger companies. They did that in the 1980s with the SNLs, for example, and they did it in the 30s with the Reconstruction Finance Corp. You know, they forcibly made some of the smaller banks merge with some of the bigger banks. And that's part of the strategy here as well. But the real fundamental strategy and part of Obama and Bush before is really to try to somehow keep the whole thing from collapsing and hope that it recovers on its own, and to do that primarily with the credit system, the financial system, banking system, and perhaps just selectively with non-financial corporations. So you won't see much in terms of additional bailouts going on. They've bailed out the worst of the Big 19. You know, they're not going to bail out the regional banks and smaller businesses and so forth. They're just going to go under.
But if we have a second financial crisis, they will go back and they'll help the big boys again.
There'll be a second round of consolidation if there is a second one. Yeah.
Well,
and there could very well be in 2010. You know, you only need another really big financial collapse somewhere, some big bank. It doesn't even have to be in the U.S. It could be in Europe. And, you know, you'll be confidence, the lack of confidence will again become very evident, and the stock market will drop another 20% overnight virtually. And, you know, be right back where you are. It's a very tenuous situation that they're in right now.
Well, this thing began in 2007. I forget the month. It might have been mid-year, maybe the spring. I forget. Some small bank in Germany I never heard of went under. And I heard about it, and I said, well, you know, banks go under all the time. But that, I guess, was the canary in the coal mine, because it showed that the sickness that small bank had was the same sickness that many other banks had, except they hadn't collapsed yet until they did.
Right. In early 2007, we started seeing some of the mortgage companies, New Century and others, go under. I think the threshold event was in May, June of 2007, when two hedge funds of Bear Stearns, which were heavily exposed to subprimes, actually went broke, and Bear Stearns you know, couldn't resurrect them, tried for several months. And then it became very apparent that there was a systemic problem here, and they quick tried to patch things up until late July, early August 2007. That's when the whole subprime thing blew up. And from there, of course, all the other consumer credit and other credit markets began to be impacted very, very quickly, by the way. And within a couple of months, December 2007, the real recession began. So this thing transmitted very quickly in just a matter of a couple months, and then it moved into its second more serious stage with the collapse of all the banks, the banking panic in 2008, September 2008, and within a month, consumption, investment, and jobs began falling off a cliff. Jobs started gushing at 1 million a month, and it sort of slowed down a little bit. But not much. I know my view is it's still declining in a number of sectors and areas. And all you've got is not a recovery. That, you need to make that very clear. It's not a recovery. It's a slowdown of the collapse, which is quite different. But they're spinning it as a recovery. You know, stock market up 15% from its lows. It does not constitute an economic recovery.
Oh, not at all. The bomb that concerns me a great deal is the commercial real estate one. You put a number on it, $800 billion. Do you see that beginning to go off this year, or do you see it next year?
Oh, no, it's going off right now.
But slowly.
Yeah, it's happening right now. You've got commercial property and companies, investment companies. You know, commercial property is office buildings and resorts and hotels and multi-unit family apartment buildings and so forth. That's malls, and they're collapsing all over right now. That's what TALF is going to try to do, the Fed's TALF program, supposedly to get the shadow banking system those folks that gave us a lot of the crisis here, the hedge funds and so forth, to try to get them to buy up these commercial property assets. But it's not happening. You know, they passed that in February, March, and the Fed and the TALF have yet to really accomplish anything. So I'm very pessimistic that the Fed and TALF program is going to be able to put a floor under the collapse of the commercial property market. I think that's that train's left the station.
I think my real question is, when will this real estate bomb resonate in more big trouble for the big banks?
Well, I'm not so sure it'll hit the big banks as hard as it'll hit the regional small community banks. I think that's where the greater pressure is going to be as far as this commercial property, because this the commercial property tends to be very local and regionalized, you know. So that's always been the sphere of the regional banks much more. I'm not saying the big banks aren't involved in that, but, you know, that's really their market, you might say. So, you know, we already have 300 banks, according to the FDIC, a very conservative number, on the watch list, and estimates are, you could lose up to 900 of these small regional banks, and that's quite possible, I think.
One thing that, of course, the big banks have operations everywhere, but one thing that some of them are very heavily into is credit cards.
Yes, yeah, there's a lot of loans going to credit card companies. They're very much tied into that, and that's why you see a collapse of credit going on as far as credit cards are concerned, which, by the way, also feeds back into small businesses. People aren't aware that most of the small businesses float operational loans with their credit cards and typically had $40,000-$50,000 credit lines. Well, when those credit lines are being eliminated or reduced to very low levels, which the credit card companies are doing, then you've got a lot of small businesses, proprietors and so forth, who can't keep their businesses going, and they go under. So, you know, that's another source of the big problems. And that's why they're talking about, well, we can give more money to Small Business Association, the FBA, government agency, to loan to small businesses. Well, you know, they only address 1% of the small business market. That's not going to have any impact at all. Small business is going to take a big, big hit, along with, you know, workers losing their jobs in the millions. Both of those are going to be the main recipients of the crisis here, which is just exactly what happened in the early 30s as well.
The fact that small businesses are always hurt the most during times of recession or depression, Jack. And that's another thing that puts a lie to the mythical job creation that the labor report.
Yes, of course. You know, I mean, the small businesses are disappearing in the hundreds of thousands while they're adding them to the employment rolls in the hundreds of thousands. It's absurd.
Oh, it's absolutely crazy. In times of expansion, then small businesses absolutely would be creating lots of jobs.
Mm-hmm.
But now they're leeching them because they're going under. There are always new ones that are starting up. You get some guy that loses his job somewhere. Where he may open up some kind of a proprietorship doing whatever. He may hire somebody to come in with him. Well, big deal. For everyone like that, you may have a dozen others that are going under, losing all these jobs. Another big one, Jack, is what's going on in the States. California is the
mm-hmm.
biggest state.
Yes.
So that gets the most headlines. But it definitely is impacting Illinois, where I live. It's impacting most every single state in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Is that another real major bomb?
Yes, very much so. And it's a reflection that as this recovery, lack of recovery drags out, the pressures on the states get larger and larger. For example, you know, in the Obama stimulus program, they've earmarked about $130 million for state assistance here, most of it coming next year, not this year. But the states are projecting they're going to have to reduce their spending by $200-$250 billion. So the Obama program, stimulus program, only provides about half of the loss that's coming in the states. And you've got a pretty general practice going on now where furloughs, 4 days out of the month, people are being forced to take time off without pay, which is a hidden unemployment that's occurring in massive amounts. And we're going to see a lot of even direct layoffs in the states. occur.
They're wrestling with the same thing in Illinois, Jack.
Yes, honestly, Illinois, right.
I don't keep up with it, but I know one thing the governor wants is an increase in the personal income tax. I don't think he's talking about raising business taxes. I would doubt it very much. An increase in the personal income tax. Well, to raise taxes during a time of duress, again, is an insane thing to do. And like all the other states, cutting social services, firing people. Again, this is a formula for disaster.
Well, they're cutting education spending in California by $8 to $9 billion. Like I said, the whole $26 billion package is at the expense of services and jobs at a time when it should be just the opposite. And California, see, is always in this crisis because its whole tax structure is upside down. In the best of times, it can barely cover its budgets, and in the worst of times, it can't. And that all has to do with Prop 13 and eliminating taxes on businesses and corporations and wealthy individuals. And that's part of the problem here. You know, for 30 years, the top wealthiest 5%, one or 5% households have had massive tax cuts. You know, just under Bush in the first term, $3.7 trillion in tax cuts, 80% of which went to the wealthiest 5%. Well, you've just messed up your whole budget structure here. Unless you do something about that, you're always going to be in a deficit.
Jack, let's take another break. We'll come back and finish up with the last segment. The hour does fly by. We'll be right back. Our final segment with Jack Rasmus. Jack, it's a lot easier assessing the present situation than looking ahead and predicting the future. I would hesitate to guess what would happen tomorrow, let alone 6 months or a year from now, but it certainly doesn't look good. You want to take a shot and give listeners an idea where you see things going in the next year, 2 years or so?
Let me paraphrase it this way. Their whole strategy is to pump trillions of dollars, which they've done, into the banks, commercial banks in particular, since the shadow banks have collapsed, and in the hopes that, you know, they will eventually turn to lending to the real economy, and, you know, the real economy will recover. So everything's predicated on this assumption that the $4 trillion so far and the potential $8 trillion more that they've put into the banks is going to somehow get into the real economy and generate a recovery. Okay. Have the banks started lending again despite this $4 trillion? No. That enough is an indication that there's no recovery really underway around the corner. Well, how is it then that they are reporting that the banks are actually lending again? Well, it's another trick. Here's how it happens. If you're a commercial bank and you take the assets of a collapsed bank like Washington Mutual onto your books, it looks like you've increased loans. If you're a commercial bank, you know, one of the big 19, and you've been running all of these off-balance sheet structured investment vehicles where you've been hiding all this securitized investment, if you take those assets onto your balance sheet, looks like you've increased your loans. You borrow from the Fed, your assets increase. Looks like you've increased your loans. That's, by the way, why these big banks can say, oh, they look like they're more profitable. Their assets are rising, right? Well, they're rising because they're acquiring, and this relates directly to your comment about Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan. They're acquiring these other failed institutions, so it looks like their assets are rising. But true bank lending is continuing to plummet. From highs in 2007, it's still falling through the floor. And, of course, loans for home purchases, they are in negative territory as well. So the whole strategy predicated on bank lending, credit lending, as they say, get the credit lending going again, is not happening. At the same time, you've got all these projected defaults in non-bank corporations. CIT is a good example of that, right? And you've got the collapse of jobs here by those corporate non-bank companies that are trying to survive by laying people off or lowering wages. There's two ways they're doing that, are converting 7 million people from full-time to part-time. Those are the techniques that are being used by non-bank companies in order to stay afloat while there's no credit flowing. So fundamentally, it's not working. You know, we're not getting a pickup in bank lending, even though we've given them trillions of dollars. That alone is proof that there's no real recovery underway.
Oh, indeed, so we're out of time again. I said smoke and mirrors. And the media play it up like, well, things really are improving.
Mm-hmm.
And you explain it so clearly to people. Always you tell me things I didn't know before, which is why it's so terrific having you back on. And I'm sure listeners feel exactly the same way. So we have to keep this up, Jack. So you can, we'll call it a running soap opera.
Okay.
So we can tell listeners what really is happening in the economy and what they can expect. I think a lot of them already know because it's already happened to them.
Well, my new book, Epic Recession, The Prelude to Global Depression, will be coming out soon, and maybe we can talk about that.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Jack, many thanks again. I'll shoot you an email as soon as we go off here.
My pleasure.
Thanks.
All right.
And join us again on Monday. We'll have another full week for you. Please join us then.